Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, coming at you once again to finally do this Q&A episode that I've been promising for about 200 years. I've received too many questions over that time to possibly fit them all into this single episode, and there are also a lot of repeat questions, so I'll try to get through as many as I can with as much specificity as possible. As always, most episodes of Cold Case Murder Mysteries are available by premium subscription on coldcasemurdermysteries.com, so head on over and sign up today for access to the latest episodes in the catalog. And yes, I know I mention this every time I have a free episode, but when you have a show like this, it's inevitable that you're going to piss off a lot of people to the extent they quit, so new members are required to fill that vacuum. It's an unfortunate part of the process, but it comes with the territory of being audacious, bold, and innovative, for better or worse. I tend to do whatever makes the show more popular, and last week's episode, no matter how upsetting it might have been, helped me reach the download total I promised my sponsor in the first 4 days of a 30-day period. So, it's difficult for me to please everybody. Some people like me to go off on crazy tangents, and others hate it. Some people want to hear me talk about the future, and others only want to hear specifically about the crime in question. I try to mix it up to accommodate everybody, but any attempt at pleasing each person listening is a hard lesson in futility. The only thing I refuse to do in the process is pretend to be somebody I'm not for the purpose of commercialism. Podcasting is the rare platform that allows creators extensive autonomy, so I'm just indulging it. Anyhow, remember to download the show's free app in the App Store for your iPhone, or in Google Play for the Android version. Donations to the show can be made directly on coldcasemurdermysteries.com. Just look for the donation link on the homepage. Beyond that, your 5-star ratings and reviews, wherever you listen, are greatly appreciated and help others to find the show. Okay, that's enough of the business. Let's do this. First question. If you could see one case solved, what would it be? This is one I've received quite often, and I have various reasons for why I'd like to see a case solved, from curiosity to wanting the victim and or their family to receive justice in the case. But in terms of curiosity, the disappearance of Brian Schaefer from a bar in Columbus, Ohio back in 2006 is really intriguing. Not only do we not know where he ended up, alive or dead, but we also don't know how he left the building that night because he wasn't captured on video cameras. My assessment of that case was that he likely left the building of his own volition and did so in a manner that wasn't caught on camera, whether he climbed out of a window or there was a failure in the motion-activated video recording on one of the doors that caused a delay to miss him when he walked out. I think he was either involved in a freak accident after leaving that precipitated his death in a place he wouldn't be found, or, perhaps more likely, he was using drugs that night and, under the influence of alcohol, sought more drugs in the local area surrounding the bar that led to an attempted robbery in which he fought back, was killed, and was subsequently disposed of somewhere. Regardless, I hope we have answers someday, but that one probably piques my curiosity more than any other because I think the truth is probably very simple and straightforward in a way that we can't see it 2 inches in front of our faces. In terms of a case where I'd like to see justice for the victim, the disappearance of Aisha DeGree definitely haunts me to my core. Just thinking of that little girl walking down the highway in freezing rain in the middle of the night draws an emotional reaction because I know the pain she was experiencing that led to it would have to be the result of desperately trying to escape something in her life. A lot of people want to believe she was gullible and was groomed, but asking a little girl to walk down a highway in freezing weather while getting rained on without a coat is not how a pedophile lures a child. You create comfort to draw somebody toward you, not misery. She was running from something that had always been chasing her, and at the end, it finally caught up. Terribly sad story. On that note, though, I was really happy to learn that Angie Houseman's killer was finally brought to justice after nearly 3 decades. The suffering she endured during her abduction, especially in her final hours, definitely haunts me for sure. Of course, I think anything involving children is just truly awful. So, with that said, I'd also like to see justice for JonBenet Ramsey and Madeleine McCann, but their parents are prominent white people, who will very likely never face criminal punishment. They've been protected by money to an extent it's nothing less than totally disgusting and unwarranted, but that's the way the justice system works. In all honesty, you could probably pick any case to fit the bill on this question, because it's difficult to not want justice for anybody who's met such a demise, or even the family who deals with it in the aftermath. Okay, next question. What was your first job? Wow, that's way back. It was either delivering newspapers or hanging flyers from a local pizza shop on people's door handles. This was back in the day when you could actually approach someone's house and even knock on the door without getting shot or having the police called. But what I really enjoyed about the paper route is that every week or 2 weeks, we had to go around to each person's door in the evening when they got home to collect what they owed. So sometimes they'd invite me in, or they'd ask me to wait at the door. But either way, it was really entertaining because I would examine the physical presentation of the person and their home in relation to what their emotional disposition would be because of it. Sometimes I would reverse engineer the condition of the interior of the home, meaning how it went from being new to becoming cluttered and disorganized, and then map out the trajectory of that person's emotional wounds leading to a physical decline within the home, using the interior of the house as a metaphor for their brain. By extension of doing that, my brain would conjure an image of who and what these people were when they were younger, prior to that decay. Obviously, it's way more interesting and apparent when you do this with somebody whose life is seemingly deteriorating, but it works just as well for those who are sparing no expense in trying to maintain an image of perfection for their neighbors. In those cases, I had to work harder to see the cracks in their dam, but once I found the weak link, their emotional reality would come flooding into view. So, everything I look at tends to be like fireworks, especially behavior. It's big, bright, and spectacular, no matter how mundane or insignificant it might seem to others. It can be overwhelming at times, or cause social anxiety that makes me withdraw. I mean, a lot of people complain about social anxiety in the context of being around a lot of other people and feeling pressure to fit in, or to be entertaining, or anything similar. But for me, it has everything to do with sensory overload. Sometimes the fireworks can get too close, and if they're going off right in front of my face for hours, it can be exhausting to process all of that information. Because I definitely have this strange condition, which would be most easily described as my brain having a mind of its own. What I mean is that we're all raised in a social context, from a behavioral standpoint, but my brain is constantly calculating evolutionary value in relation to behavior and its correlation to technology. It desperately wants me to follow the flow of resources to extract truth from any situation, even if I'm supposed to be doing nothing more than socializing with small talk. This happens because society, including my parents, beat social norms into my head from day one of my life, but my brain is like, nope, sorry, I have different plans. So, I can be talking to someone, just trying to enjoy the conversation, and suddenly, my brain is like, stop talking, shut your fucking mouth, just listen, and then report back to me about this person's underlying emotional truth. Of course, that led to me being a terrible student. My teachers would be in the midst of a lesson with a quiz to follow on what we learned, and meanwhile, I'm evaluating their clothes and speech patterns to understand why they're on the verge of a divorce. Anyway, next question. What's your favorite color? That would be the same shade of green as my eyes. If I wear a shirt that color to make them match, it causes me to be happy, and I notice other people like it too, so I'd probably go with that. I tend to have a very cold, minimalistic, architectural type of palette when it comes to things like this. If no one would complain, I'd probably own nothing but gray clothes, and as I've mentioned on the show in the past, I'm like a bull ready to charge when I see a fair-skinned white man in a red shirt. I don't know why, but I find it so upsetting enough that I can't even bring myself to analyze the cause. Next question. What books influenced you in your youth? Well, it would have to be in my youth because I very rarely read anything these days. In fact, the last book I read was 3 years ago. It was the Ruth Ware novel, In a Dark, Dark Wood. Somebody recommended it to me because it was very atmospheric in a psychological sense. But in terms of what influenced or inspired me, number one on that list has to be Stephen King. Among his efforts, my favorites were Pet Sematary, The Langoliers, The Long Walk, Misery, The Shining, Different Seasons, which included the novellas The Body and Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption, that were adapted into the films Stand By Me and The Shawshank Redemption, respectively. Also loved Dolores Claiborne, The Mist, and Thinner, among others. Speaking of Thinner, Thinner actually had this great line that I think applies to so many of these cases we read about where privilege lets the guilty walk. The protagonist, a professional white guy who's used to getting his way and thinks he can always fix his problems with ease, ends up hitting a woman with his car, at which point he tries to talk his way out of the consequences because the victim and the man she's with are from a traveling culture, described as gypsies in the book, but I don't think that would be the PC term all these years later. Anyhow, as the protagonist is trying to manipulate a situation in which he won't suffer any consequences for this incident, letting them all just go on their way, the man he's speaking to says, "There is no push, white man from town. Everybody pays." And that's exactly what I wish the cowards in Boulder, Colorado, who capitulated to the Ramses, had said. Anyhow, I've definitely been influenced and inspired by many other authors. My love for the brilliant work of Anton Chekhov drew me into the world of playwriting, and spawned an affection for works by Edward Albee, David Mamet, but even more so Harold Pinter. His work was incredibly mysterious, and yet still offered an emotional truth that was always entirely apparent to the reader. Yet, as much as I love to see plays, I had an equal affinity for reading them, which I guess is just a byproduct of being a writer. Now, in terms of what's had the most profound effect on me as an adult, I'd have to go with two books by the same author. Aristotle's The Poetics is nothing less than profound, yet told with such simplicity, almost, you know, as though it's a textbook. It's a manual for how to live a truthful life, as well as an instructional guide for writing great drama. Granted, his views on women are totally cringeworthy, but it would be fair to say that they were consistent with the times a couple of thousand years ago. Now, while The Poetics focuses on truth, he also wrote something called The Art of Rhetoric, which, while equally brilliant, is absolutely disgusting in the sense that it's a manual designed to accommodate the polar opposite value of The Poetics, which is to say, it instructs you how to live a dishonest, manipulative existence to gain power in society. In layman's terms, it's a book about how to be a politician. I have never been so enlightened as when I read The Poetics, and never more offended than having read The Art of Rhetoric. My brain interprets politics as trash and the truth as gold, so the dichotomy those books offered painted a very clear picture of human nature for me, from the best of what we are to the worst. Lastly, I'd say my favorite short story is The Lottery by Shirley Jackson. It offers an abundance of timeless social relevance, but even if you ignore those elements, it still stands on its own as a terrifying, suspenseful little nightmare of a tale. Obviously, it's inspired countless efforts throughout the years since it was published, with one obvious example being the opening of The Hunger Games. Okay, next one. Who is your favorite serial killer? I always have to laugh when I hear the question posed like that, because we definitely live in a society that tends to glorify the bad guy, so to speak. But I can surely answer it from the standpoint of the person I find most intriguing. Jeffrey Dahmer would be number one on that list. His emotional ailments led to some of the most bizarre, deranged behavior I've ever encountered. Most serial killers, while they do kill in a futile attempt to reconcile childhood trauma, to close the gap on that emotional wound, also tend to have anger consistent with the abuse that led to it. But Dahmer's household as a child, while not ideal, offered normalcy to an extent you couldn't possibly conceive that it would lead to creating zombies with a power drill to the skull, followed by injecting battery acid. At the heart of his issues, though, is that he was so desperate to give and receive love, without the ability to make it happen in society, that he tried to manipulate a solution by performing heinous, inhuman experiments on other human beings. He is generally considered the most notorious serial killer in history, and while the superficial reason was his cannibalism and related behavior, the truth below that surface says one thing very clearly. nothing is more difficult for a person than the struggle to communicate to other humans that we're lonely and need to be loved. Another would be Ted Bundy. I'm less impressed with the sociopathic charm and more intrigued by his extreme hatred of women due to the issues surrounding his mother. The biggest lie anybody ever told him, which was that his grandmom was his mother and his mother was really his sister, when revealed for what it was, created an emotional wound that he could not heal through practical means and caused the anger to physically manifest in the rape, torture, and murder of women. If you look at his crimes, especially the ones where he pretended to be injured and even wore a fake cast, what he was doing is taking his distrust of women who had lied to him his whole life and turning it around on them so that they could suffer for the rest of their lives after trusting him. It was revenge. Ted was symbolically reversing the emotional situation with his mom and sister to get revenge. The fake cast was the physical manifestation of his emotional wound or vulnerability caused by women, so what he did was lure them with it into a situation that, just like with his mom and sister, turned out to be a lie. Once he sucked them into the trap, meaning into the void of the emotional gap caused by that lie from women, symbolized by the cast, aka wound, which literally hides a wound you're trying to heal, Ted would reveal the truth and hurt them just like his mom and sister did to him. So, essentially, from a symbolic standpoint, he would lure women into the emotional gap caused by the lie, as was done to him, and then punish them for it. If you notice, his most legendary feat, the one which actually saw him reach the peak of his success as a serial killer, before he started to unravel, was the incident at Lake Sammamish in the summer of 1974. On that day, Ted used that cast trick to kidnap not one, but two women, which he tortured, raped, and killed. It's said he made one watch the other die, and then turned his attention to the second one. Obviously, Ted's greatest fantasy was to use the fake cast to draw not one, but two women into the mix because it mirrors the situation involving his mom and sister. He was lied to by both of them, so using that cast as the physical manifestation of his emotional wound to lure them into a lie that would cause them pain for the rest of their lives was the satisfaction he sought. His mother and grandmother drew him into the lie, so he needed to fulfill the fantasy of turning the tables on them by taking revenge on two women who were unsuspecting of their fate, just as he was when he was a kid and women lied to him and caused him pain from which he could not recover. He just did it to them. But what's really interesting is that you can't solve an emotional issue through physical means unless it involves emotional change. So, the desired result Ted was after, which was feeling as though he'd been vindicated by taking his anger out on two women he manipulated in the way he'd been manipulated by his mom and grandmom, was a failure. And if you know Bundy's criminal history well, this crime was the peak of his career as a serial killer. He began to unravel emotionally and get sloppy and desperate after that day, leading to his capture and arrest, because he came to realize his methods weren't going to solve his problem. He didn't feel better. He felt worse. Ted claims this had nothing to do with why he raped and killed, but that means nothing coming from one of the more manipulative people to have ever walked the earth. In truth, he couldn't deal with it emotionally, and he was unable to get over that hurdle, so he buried his head in the sand and hid from it. But every person's emotional issues leave a physical imprint. It's unavoidable. So yes, to answer the question I can hear you asking in silence, we can do a Bundy episode. Of course, I find many other killers fascinating as well. Richard Ramirez, John Wayne Gacy, Eileen Wuornos, the Golden State Killer and all of his related crimes as the East Area Rapist and Visalia Ransacker, Ed Kemper, Zodiac, so many more. All right, next question. I mentioned a dog I used to own in an episode one time, and there's a question about his name and why I spread his ashes near the Chaminade Ramsey House in Boulder, Colorado, when he died under tragic circumstances. So, the dog was a Westie, but a total genetic freak who had incredible strength for a dog that size. Most adult male Westies run about 17 to 20 pounds, or maybe a little more, but he was 32 pounds and rock solid muscle. It was really strange. So, one day he tried to chase the mailman at my apartment building through a glass door that was closing. Basically, it closed and he kept running, thinking the glass was just open space in the doorframe. He was such an alpha that he was dumb as a rock. I mean, this was the most brain-dead animal I've ever encountered, but he was a physical specimen for sure. So he ran headfirst into the door, injured his spine, and the vet neglected to realize the injury had caused a blood clot. I took him back when he didn't recover very well, but they assured me he just needed more time to heal. The next morning, he dropped dead right in front of me on the floor, maybe flopping like a fish out of water for a few seconds, but by the time I dialed the animal hospital, he was already gone. I think he was just a few weeks from his third birthday. So, I lived in Denver, Colorado at the time, and I had him cremated before taking the ashes to a hiking trail in Boulder called the Anu White Trail, which is not only a great place to get stalked and killed by a mountain lion, but has a windy creek running through it that goes down a hill. It was his favorite place in the world, so I climbed to the start of the creek at the top of the hill and let his ashes go there so he could be a part of it forever. His name was Alex, but his full name was Alexander of Gaugamela. Of course, it's a reference to Alexander the Great, the most innovative general in the history of warfare, but also notes his greatest victory at the Battle of Gaugamela against the Persian Empire in what would now be considered northern Iraq, I believe. And that's that. Next question. Are you a Republican or a Democrat? Oh, bringing politics into the mix. Well, neither. My brain seeks truth to an extent that politicized information reaches my intellectual palate with the distinct taste of something that came out of a back alley fish market dumpster on a hot summer afternoon. It's not a choice I've made, it's just the design of my brain. I'm not able to follow politics in the context of right and wrong or good and evil. I can only interpret evolutionary function as it pertains to resources. So, whereas you might see something happening in the world as being cruel and unjust, my brain seeks the reason it's happening, and in relation to resources, to render the equation that justifies evolution's purpose for imposing that suffering. Basically, I watch evolution turn the faucet on and off in society, specifically in the way it regulates the use of resources. I can trace every problem right back to its roots, meaning one quintessential question that answers everything, and it equates to this inquiry. What is the specific deficit of resources causing the issue? Every social problem is spawned by evolution's fear of humanity overextending resources in situations where there's not enough creation. When we overextend, it turns the faucet off. When we have a surplus, it turns the faucet back on. And it does all of this in relation to technology. So, in my world, there are obviously a lot of people who do terrible things to others, but they absolutely don't do it simply because they're bad people. That's why I discuss evolution manipulating society like a puppet master. If you know the game, you pay attention to how it works, instead of playing the game itself. Evolution, as of this time, needs about 99.9% of the population to play the game, but as technology rises around us, it needs to gradually unveil the game for what it is, and for the purpose of making you angry enough to transcend it through replacement of the human brain, which allows detachment from evolution's design and limitations. I'll give you a great example of how this works. There was a mass shooting a couple of days ago, one in which a 6-year-old boy was killed, among others. Truly awful. In the aftermath, people are immediately calling for gun control, which is great, but it doesn't solve the issue at its root cause. Mentally ill people are the problem, and their issues stem from what's wrong inside their heads. Replacing the brain through AI kills two birds with one stone because it not only extracts the mental illness of the perpetrator, but also the fragile mortality of the victims. It's a big win. So, the gun is the weed growing above the surface. The brain is the roots entrenched beneath. Yet, the socially oriented human sees gun control as a solution because the socially oriented brain is designed to chop down weeds to the surface rather than dig down and uproot the problem entirely. Here's why. Gun control, in the context of technology, is feasible at this time. Replacing the human brain is not. So, evolution needs 99.9% of people to think like that. Meanwhile, since replacing the brain is still a lofty goal, something we can achieve with today's technology, the remaining portion of the population, which is tiny in comparison, is going to see the real, long-term solution that eradicates the weed from its roots, rather than continually chopping it down to the surface. The job of this tiny minority of people is to give momentum to a movement toward the truth, a snowball effect. So picture this. People suffer unnecessarily at the hands of a maniacal gunman, and you have a socially oriented brain. If you lean toward the liberal side, you might suggest gun control is the answer. If you lean toward the conservative side, you might suggest owning a gun to defend yourself is the answer. Each of those opinions creates a two-pronged conflict in which evolution can regulate the actions taken to remedy the situation. And as often happens, there's a huge stalemate involving very little social progress toward making either side happy. What's happening is that evolution manipulates the situation to move toward a solution at the same rate that related technology comes into play. It wants you to argue continually in the absence of being able to fix the real problem at its root with technology. The reason this happens is that it wants you to be distracted from the real solution because trying to employ the real solution prior to the technology being ready could jeopardize the future of the human race. We can all become immortal by being AI, but if we become robots in a hasty manner that betrays solid technological advance, we could destroy the future in the process. So when you look across the table at people who have opposing views to yours, it isn't a result of them being ignorant or evil. It's the product of design. My brain, being impractical for use in social matters, such as arguing against the other side, so to speak, follows the trajectory of the resources to see not only the root of the issue, but the projection of how it will be fixed in the future. I ignore the manipulation because I see it for what it is, and I refuse to participate in it. Now, almost everybody is intended to participate in that. It's a necessary process. And your inclusion, or my exclusion, is not indicative of an intellectual advantage or disadvantage, regardless of how you frame it. It just dictates what we see and feel. So, in the same way you might fight to retain your right to owning a firearm, and another person might seek more favorable conditions for migrants entering the country, my brain goes straight to the ultimate solution, so to speak, and lobbies for the change I want to see in the world, but on an evolutionary level, in relation to technology. My brain bypasses social considerations in favor of technological solutions to these issues. So, evolution designs very few brains like mine because it needs to dissuade others from believing me until the technology is ready. Which means your reaction to my show, if you like it, should be one where you say, you know, there's something interesting about that guy, but he goes off on tangents where I have no idea what the hell he's talking about. Is he crazy? What's the deal? That's what evolution wants. I'm just planting seeds for the future, and my expectation is not to have anybody agree right now. Agreement is a social consideration that does very little to enhance my analysis of evolutionary function. So, the end result is that I say a lot of things that upset people, but it's definitely not my intention. My brain is just very mechanical. Like everybody else, I'm just speaking my truth, and I think we all have an obligation to do that. I try to be a considerate person, but, you know, sometimes I fail. Okay, next question. What is your dream car? Anything Audi makes is my dream car. A black R8 with black leather would be ideal. I have a 2011 A4 in the same color, so I just sort of pretend it's one of the better models. Alright, next one. How do you fit into the true crime community? I don't? No, you know, I'm a very introverted, analytical person, So I spend the majority of my time researching and writing. I don't do much on social media, and the occasions when I have, I ended up feeling like my efforts weren't really worth the time. So it's fairly obvious my true crime show is much, much different than the rest of them. And that's usually a good indication the creator is like that in relation to the other podcasters. So I think the true crime podcasting community does a great job at its mission, which, of course, varies by person or show. But for the most part, I tend to do my own thing. I like to think I contribute to the genre as a result of my hard work, but I'm not sure if I fit the mold of having a role in the community, if that makes sense. Okay, next question. If you could personally solve one case as the detective, which one would it be? Oh, that's a good one. If I were the detective, I might be interested in a few cases. I'm not so sure I could narrow it down to just one. Some of them are as follows. The Walker family murders in Osprey, Florida would be one. That's the one where Dick Hickok and Perry Smith were suspected after they committed the infamous murders of the Clutter family, which was basically immortalized in Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. That one's still unsolved today. That's a really interesting case. Dorothy Jane Scott is another. She was abducted in her own car outside of a hospital after receiving strange and threatening calls from an unknown man. And then, when her remains were discovered a few years later, the killer started taunting her family with similar calls. So, that one's super creepy. I would love to examine that. Of course, I'd love to prove what actually happened in the JonBenet Ramsey case. For me, that's the pinnacle of fascination and mystery when it comes down to it. Since that was my first episode, I'm planning to redo it with a much longer version that takes a really deep dive into all of the evidence and surrounding circumstances. So that should be fun. A couple others would be maybe the Austin Yogurt Shop murders, that's really interesting, and the Las Cruces Bowling Alley Massacre, that's also another unsolved one that probably should have been solved. Those two are definitely on my radar. You know, one that really haunts me, which is local to where I was born, is The Boy in the Box. For anyone who doesn't know that one, he was an emaciated boy who was obviously abused, beaten to death, and dumped in a box on the side of the road in a wooded area in northeast Philly in 1957. One of the detectives on the case spent in excess of 2 decades on it, I think maybe even closer to 3, and he still came up empty. I think it would be great to learn who the kid is, and maybe even more importantly, to restore his identity, if nothing else. So there are many others, but those are just a few off the top of my head. Okay, next question. If you didn't analyze the psychology of crime, what area would you go into? I'm assuming that means still in the field of crime, just not in psychology. You know, I might be too crazy to have any type of official role in the investigation of a murder, but I definitely enjoy watching how forensic evidence tells a story. Anything that creates a compelling narrative is exciting for me, so I think I'd probably go in that direction. I might study forensic psychology or some related endeavor. On the other end of that spectrum, I definitely have no place in law enforcement, that's for sure. I would be the worst cop ever to wear a badge. Instead of drawing my gun in a dangerous situation with a suspect, I'd be like, "I know what you're suffering emotionally. I can see it by the way your shoes are tied." So yeah, I'd probably avoid that aspect of criminal justice. All right, so we're going to have a quick word from our sponsor here, and I'll be right back. Hey guys, Ryan Krause here. I'm curious, are you happy with the amount of money you make? How does the opportunity to start making $40,000 a year sound? Even better, what if I told you you could double that to $80,000 in just a few years? Do I have your attention? Well, if so, you should check out truck driving jobs. With the improved economy and high-flourishing commercial trucking industry, the demand for truck drivers is definitely high right now. CDL.com makes it easy for you to get a commercial driving license and find the job that's right for your needs. Find opportunities in your town or over the road. Create a driver profile. access high-paying, long-term, and short-term truck driving jobs. Plus, apply to these jobs in just minutes. With plenty of new jobs and schools around the country, you can get your trucking career started at CDL.com. Explore a truckload of jobs for the trucker in you. Again, that's CDL.com. Okay, and we're back. Next question. You mentioned in an episode that you used to be a playwright. What was the play called? Well, I've written a handful of plays, but never really got too serious about it because times were changing when I started, and I didn't feel like there would be ample opportunities to thrive in that business. So, anyway, I won something back in the day called the Roger Cornish Award, which was named after a longtime playwriting instructor at Rutgers University, who had passed away a few years earlier. That was a psychological thriller called Vindication, Illinois, which was highly metaphysical in nature and very surreal, to say the least. The award was only a small amount of money and a plaque, but what was amazing is that it came with a full production by the theater that sponsored the competition I won. So I got to watch everything from the initial table reads with the actors and director, to the play shaping over time in rehearsal, right up to the props being constructed and the show running for 8 weeks, and also reviews appearing in local publications. So yeah, it was a great experience. Seeing a live audience react to your writing is definitely magical, for sure. But the best part of the experience was when it was over. After the last show, I was approached by this little elderly woman being escorted toward me by the head of the theater company. I could see tears in her eyes, and I wondered who she was. And then she says, "My husband is the man they named this award after, and I just want to tell you something. He didn't have your talent, but he was inspirational to the people he taught. So he might not be with us anymore, but he would be so proud of you today. I hope you'll keep him in your thoughts." Of course, I have, and always will. A week later, I got a call from a woman at a much bigger, more prominent theater requesting to meet me for coffee. I had no idea why, but I showed up because she had worked with some huge playwrights. I mean, legendary names. At the time, she was working with a Pulitzer Prize winner, so I didn't understand why she'd want to speak with me. So I get there, and she's like, "I was the final judge in the competition you won, and I need to tell you something. They gave me 3 plays to read, and the other 2 were better than yours. But those people will never amount to anything artistically, because they have very little to say about the world." So, of course, I'm wondering why she decided to tell me that. And she goes on to say, "I need to tell you this so that you can understand who you are as an artist. You'll go as far as you want with your writing, but you'll have to work twice as hard as everybody else to get there." And I think those are the greatest words of wisdom anyone has ever spoken to me. That's been my artistic life every moment of every day since that time. She talked about how polarizing I am, and how I can annoy and enlighten people in the same sentence, and what a burden it would become. And of course, she was 100% right. But those words allowed me to never quit on my dreams. I keep taking chances and suffering the criticism because I believe. I always will. So yeah, I really got a lot out of that playwriting situation. It was beyond amazing. Oh, and then there was a second award. This one is pretty funny though. I get a call from somebody at a local theater company in Philly, and he says, "Hey, you entered a play in our competition last year, right?" And I thought of Vindication, Illinois, but he says, "No, it was a one-act play, not a full-length." And suddenly I remembered. I was like, "Oh, okay. What about it?" And he says, "Well, to be frank, all of the submissions we received this year for our one-act contest are really bad. We promised a production of the play, and we don't feel like any of them are worthy." So I said, "Okay, how can I help you?" And he says, "Well, you entered that one-act play in the contest last year, and I really liked it, so I'm curious if we can just say it's the winner for this year's competition, even though you didn't enter." Of course, my first thought is, "Oh, cool." But then I think about it, and it's a recipe for bad karma. I didn't pay to enter, or even enter for free. That's not fair to the people who did. All things considered, though, I felt pressured to say yes. So I did, and I show up to accept this award, and all goes well. That's when I walked back to my car, and I was on the phone with my girlfriend at the time, who wanted to know how things went. While I'm telling her, I put the award plaque on top of the car so I can grab my keys from my pocket. The phone is in my other hand. But after opening the car door, I forget to pick up the award and just keep talking to my girlfriend. A few minutes later, when we hung up, I forgot the plaque was on the roof of the car and just drove off like that. Halfway home, I realized and stopped to look on top of the car, but it was already gone. I thought, shit, I hope that didn't fall off right where I parked. Someone from the theater will probably find it. But I was too embarrassed to ask because it was such a stupid mistake. So a few months later, still curious about it, I decided to email the guy who gave me the award. I figured if he replied to me and was nice and didn't mention it, all was good. Nobody knew. Unfortunately, he didn't reply. Not then or ever. I tried contacting another person at the company, and they ghosted me too. So, by avoiding that awkward communication to let him know I accidentally left it on the roof of my car, everybody thought I threw it on the street because it was totally meaningless. That's karma for you. But the name of that play was The Light That Shines, which I never forget because it's become such a big part of what I'm trying to do here. Okay, next up. What's your favorite part of being a podcaster and your least favorite? I don't usually speak for others, but in this case, I can tell you that every podcaster's worst nightmare is editing. Editing your audio after recording is absolutely dreadful. It's well known that podcasters generally dislike hearing their own voices, and editing requires you to listen to yourself running your mouth nonstop. Some people have highly produced shows with shorter episodes, and others, like mine, have longer episodes with lower production value. But either way, editing is really annoying. It takes forever, and you can't even do something like listen to music to make it tolerable. It's you, your awful voice, and hours of misery. And the high cost of having someone else do it makes it prohibitive for a lot of podcasters. So, yeah, editing is awful. Now, as far as what I enjoy, obviously I love creating things. I love stories. It's who I am. So for me, any opportunity to create a narrative of any kind is rewarding. But without a doubt, the part I like most about it is the messages I get from people thanking me for making a difference in their lives. Yes, some of those people go on to hate me for things I say at a later time, but that's just a product of being polarizing. I was warned the world would be like that for me, so to make a positive difference in a person's life, even if it's a couple of insights I had in some random episode, it really means a lot. Life isn't easy for anybody, but it helps to be understood, and so anything I do that fosters understanding or peace in another person's life is something for which I'm very thankful, to say the least. Okay, next one. What was your previous career? Well, I was an executive assistant to the CIO of a commercial property management company before becoming a full-time podcaster. But I think the only real career I've ever had, so to speak, was being a magazine editor. It was something I always wanted to do as a kid, but by the time I got to the age where I could go that route, print media and magazines in general were quickly dying. So, yeah. Alright, next up. Here's an interesting one. Someone said I mentioned in a past episode that I could see if somebody was guilty or innocent just by looking at their face. Now, on the surface, that sounds ridiculous, almost like I'm reading their minds. But it's actually far more practical. Well, practical for my strangeness. So here's what I meant by that. Our faces change physically and permanently over the course of our lives, and many times during the course of a day, or even a minute, on a temporary basis, like when we make various facial expressions. On top of that, when you experience trauma of any kind, whether physical or emotional, that information is obviously stored in your brain, specifically in the form of the past. All of your emotional wounds become a part of your cumulative memory and, by extension, your identity. Your face and your eyes subsequently take on the physical properties of their emotional equivalent stored in your head. So, for instance, There's that old saying about the sad clown, that the person making the jokes and laughing the most is usually the saddest one in the group. Now, you'd use that comedy in order to not show your cards. If you don't smile and laugh, your brain will default to the cumulative effect of your inner emotional disposition as the manner in which it presents your face. So again, in another instance, do you know how you might be sitting somewhere, haunted by something, and someone approaches to immediately ask what's wrong? Their analysis is physical, not emotional. You haven't told them anything through words, but they interpret everything from the look in your eyes to your body language to make an accurate assessment of your unspoken emotional disposition at the time. So throughout my life, because I'm this strange introverted analyst, I spent less time talking and more time analyzing not only how those emotional states lead to a specific physical appearance, but also how to reverse engineer the process in order to see that the narrative being offered by the brain, through the eyes, doesn't match the words coming out of the subject's mouth. The brain contains the truth, while your speech is free to spew as many lies as it wants. Yet, regardless of the deception you employ, your brain, and by extension, your eyes, can't lie. That's the reason we suggest people who avoid eye contact and blink excessively during interrogations regarding their guilt or innocence are lying. The police use this same technique, but in a different manner. One of my favorites you can watch anytime on YouTube is the cops interrogating Sandy Melgar about killing her husband. They sit one cop at one end of the room and one on the other side because it doesn't allow her to look anywhere but straight down to avoid them. We all know liars will often look down and avoid eye contact, so she can't do that too often or she'll give herself away. So what she employs is a blocking method. She uses her arms in various ways to prevent access to her eyes on numerous occasions. The reason is that the eyes can't lie. If her brain has stored information that implicates her as the killer, she'll be paranoid it's accessible through her eyes. Now, the bottom line is that what I do in this endeavor is to look for an inconsistency between what the eyes say and how the words coming out of their mouth confirm or contradict that assertion. And in the same way that you might smile when happy or frown when sad, storing traumatic information in your brain also causes physical changes to your facial features due to the continual stress related to it. If you're perpetually tortured by guilt, your face will change over time to accommodate that disposition in the same way it would if someone said something right now and your lips went from neutral to a smile. So, on a social level, we don't really need to accommodate analytical assessments beyond what you offer on the surface. But, since I'm always trying to pull back the curtain on everything and see how it works, I've monitored the changing looks of my face and eyes over the years in relation to the trauma I've experienced. So, while I'm not a murderer, thankfully, I've examined my own physical changes to my face as it pertains to the emotional trauma I've suffered in my life, and done so in the context of all sorts of negative feelings such as guilt, anxiety, depression, failure, rejection, and the list goes on. So, with that experience of examining changes to my physical presence, specifically the face and eyes, through emotional trauma, and correlated to specific feelings, I can then accurately replicate that for other people. That means when somebody claiming to be innocent offers a verbal narrative inconsistent with the physicality displayed by the eyes and face, I instantly know that person is lying. Because I've done it. We all have. You and I aren't murderers, of course. Well, at least I'm hoping you're not. But we have all protected our emotions with lies before. I'm not smarter than anybody else for doing this. I just happen to have some sensory issues that are equally debilitating and extraordinary, a blessing and a curse. So, hopefully that helps explain that craziness. Alright, next question. There was a comment by someone on Facebook that my podcast has become increasingly honed in relation to my psychoanalysis of criminals, as well as my worldview. So, the question is basically to ask how it evolved to that place, whether through my analysis of older episodes, listener input, or other means. That's a good one for sure. Like I said, it's definitely hard to please everybody, especially down to an individual level. And because the show deals with evolution, not only in terms of the physical world, but also emotionally, it does change over time. There's definitely a divide in my listenership where some people love the really out there crazy stuff where I just run my mouth incessantly. And there are others who say, fuck this. I've had enough of this shit. I'm canceling my membership. And I accept that. It's fair game. Nobody is being forced to like it, of course. But I would say that a lot of my insights come from these strange things I talk about that are unrelated to true crime, and more so geared toward human behavior. So, when you want to dig deeper, you're often going to find different things. And that's been part of the process for me. Most people just want the treasure handed over the counter to them for the listed price. As opposed to past episodes, more recently I've tended to force people to go out to the archaeological dig site more often instead of doing it myself and coming back to the retail store to hand it to them over the counter for the asking price. My instincts tell me to do that, and the show continues to get more popular in the process, so it's difficult for me to refrain from doing it when it works, despite upsetting a handful of people from time to time. So, I haven't necessarily changed what I'm doing, but I've definitely changed its presentation to a certain extent, and I'm guessing that will continue. I mean, I have other talents and other plans for things I'd like to achieve, so I feel like it's necessary for the show to evolve over time, because that's more consistent with the narrative material I enjoy writing. I do think of the show having a beginning and end, with an evolution between. Some people would play it safe because they want to do their podcast forever and don't want to compromise changing the format the audience prefers, but I think of this show in the same way you might a TV show's protagonist having a character arc. There's a beginning and also an end, but more importantly, there's a shelf life. Just like there is on each of us. So, yeah, there are other things I want to do. I have dreams and goals unrelated to this, but while I'm here, though, I want to offer an experience that evolves to its end. So if the show makes you mad one day, in one episode, it could soon be something very different. The other consideration is that I know, from my experience making art and trying to have it distributed, that this podcast offers the greatest extent of artistic freedom that I'll ever know. The level of autonomy is unparalleled. You can do whatever the hell you want. But if you work for someone else, you do what they want. I feel equally comfortable in either role, but I'm indulging this autonomy while it lasts. Okay, next question. Why haven't you covered any wrongful conviction cases? Well, that's fair. And while I have covered a few other people who have been released for wrongful convictions, those people are guilty, so they don't really count. I guess I'll have to change it up and get one in the rotation soon. Thanks for the reminder. Next question. You talk about evolution as a living, breathing thing, but most of us know it the way Darwin wrote about it. Can you explain what you mean? Sure. Do you have like 12 hours to spare? Well, anyway, I'm joking. Let's do the short version. So, something I've noted in the past is that it's not a coincidence we get the Industrial Revolution, Charles Darwin, and Carl Jung, all in the same century for the most part. They come in that order. These things are not happenstance. The world is delivered the type of evolved brains it requires as time continues. If you're wondering why our lives are so short, that's it. We make way for new technology in the form of the next generation's evolved brains. Evolution uses us in the same way you do an appliance in your kitchen. You use it for an extended period of time until it either breaks or you require something updated that has more functionality options and or a newer aesthetic. Evolution taught us to behave like that in the context of technology because that's the method it uses. So the Industrial Revolution arrives in America and Europe in the latter part of the 18th century, which means technological capability and advance are going to move at warp speed compared to how they progressed throughout history prior to that. A few decades later, Charles Darwin is born. And why? Well, with the Industrial Revolution underway, the nature of technology, and therefore evolution, changed. Evolution, up to that point, was essentially an earthbound concept related to the adaptation of the most primitive species from human predecessors right down the line, and highlighted our progression in the context of nature's guidance. Our brains developed, we shed hair, became fully bipedal, and so on. Meanwhile, birds, fish, and every other creature imaginable simultaneously made their own adaptations to ensure survival. Yet, what's important to realize is that these things all happened at a snail's pace over an incredibly extensive period of time. Evolution, for all intents and purposes, was earthbound and conducted through nature's intervention. But once the Industrial Revolution got underway, we started building things, specifically machines, that could transcend human limitation and the pace of adaptation afforded by nature. The machines we built could outpace the changes employed by nature, or evolution, and so, evolution, in the context of humans adapting through natural means over lengthy periods of time, became obsolete. So, the Industrial Revolution essentially comes to a close somewhere around 1840 or so. The civilized world is then a much different place than it had been only decades earlier. We were surrounded by machines, trains, factory equipment, textiles, steam engines, and so on. The world had more autonomy than ever, and it was afforded by innovation in a short stretch of time rather than nature over very long periods of time. All of which is to say, the Industrial Revolution started the next phase of human evolution and, in doing so, made people like Darwin ponder this question. How did we get here? How did we reach this point? So Darwin formulates his theory as to how it happened. But the mistake society makes upon consuming his work is that they believe it's an innovative manual written to teach us how the world works. But even as a child, sitting in a classroom, I found myself realizing that simply isn't true. Darwin wrote a history book. What he put to paper was a process that, while still taking place, was obsolete because technology allowed humans to outpace nature in its endeavor to make us more efficient and ensure survival. It helped us shed hair and grow larger brains. Great. Thanks for your help, but we'll take it from here. Just like your kid getting a part-time job in high school and starting to pay for things they want, in the absence of your approval, that's what technology began to afford humanity. So, while that form of evolution is in the design of our brains and will never cease to exist until we eradicate the human brain in favor of an artificial replacement, it's been obsolete for quite some time. So, Darwin watches the Industrial Revolution during his lifetime, and also sees how it culminates around 1840. By 1859, his studies and theories lead to the publication of the legendary work On the Origin of Species. And that's the key. It relates to the origin of species. It isn't a manual for how the world works, and always will. It's a roadmap that traces the trajectory of adaptation through nature up to that point. It's a history book, as most of the change moving forward would be related to humans endeavoring to create new and better technology absent of nature. The process of transcending evolution to control our own fate in AI is something I talk about a lot. But I speak about the moment we finally break free entirely by replacing the brain. Yet, that process has long since been underway. As soon as we went through the Industrial Revolution, we began to outpace nature's adaptations to an extent it became obsolete in the process. It's just like a parent trying to control a kid who's growing up and getting close to moving out of the house. They're making more and more decisions for themselves and slowly but surely extracting your overwhelming influence from the process. At some point, the day comes when they leave the nest entirely and the cord is cut. That's the part of the process humanity is in right now. Our brains, as they're connected to nature, are still forced to suffer the input and influence of evolution, but by way of creation of technology, we're getting closer and closer to cutting the cord. When we replace the brain, we extract the influence of evolution in the same way the kid growing to an adult would extract the influence of his parents. So, Darwin wrote about the first phase of evolution because, for all intents and purposes, it ended during his lifetime as it relates to humans. His work is a reflection of how we got to that point. But we have to move forward. We have to evolve. His work essentially recounts how humanity went from kindergarten through graduating high school under the guidance of its parent, aka nature. But as always, we must evolve. And since, at that time, we were making machines extraneous to ourselves, it's clear we'd already learned how to do that. The next phase of evolution then becomes cutting the cord on nature's influence. If we can outpace it through technology, it's obsolete, and therefore a necessity to leave it behind. Yet the question becomes, how do we get there? What do we do? We know how to make technology, but humanity is still entirely a product of nature. So, in 1875, after the world has absorbed the reality of the Industrial Revolution, and Darwin's work has become prominent, we needed somebody to light the way into the next phase of evolution with new ideas geared toward integrating humanity with our technology. We required a way to do the same thing evolution did for us until that point, but in the context of our technology, because it's much faster, more efficient, and will lead to the ultimate measure of survivability, which is immortality. So, if the brain is what must be removed from the evolutionary process to extract the antiquated influence of nature from our trajectory, what we desperately need at that point is someone to analyze the brain in an effort to reverse engineer its process. That will kickstart the next phase of evolution, which is an endgame involving development of an artificial operating system that, just like the kid growing up and getting a good job, ensures humanity's independence from its creator. So, with that need in mind, enter Carl Jung. And this shit just blows my mind. Seriously. So, Jung basically becomes the person who's supposed to be the successor to Freud in the newly minted field of psychoanalysis, which starts off well, but soon becomes an extremely divisive situation that makes me totally geek out. Now, let's look at the basis for their disagreement. Freud was essentially obsessed with the human libido and sexual development as core principles of his work, while Jung, who initially seemed to be on board with that in his early years, suddenly began to assert that humanity's collective unconscious was far more relevant. Okay, so look at those ideas. Freud asserts sexual development and libido for comprising our core personality. And what are they? Products of nature, specifically in relation to reproduction of humans. Jung knows it's obsolete thought, so he goes against the grain and makes his own assertions about the collective unconscious being that which comprises our core personality. This causes a rift, and Jung does not give a single fuck because he's driven to do this thing that relates to reverse engineering the brain, rather than indulging notions of sexuality. So the friendship ends, with the older man getting left in the dust by the younger man, because Jung's ideas were a more relevant post-industrial revolution reflection of necessity at that time. We were building machines at a rapid pace, and we needed somebody to dissect the functionality of the human brain to precipitate the first technology created in relation to replacing it. Accordingly, in the aftermath of publishing these works, within his lifetime, we create the first computers, which are essentially artificial brains or operating systems. And where do we end up going? On the back of much of that computer technology, right before his death? We go to the moon. And what was the last book published by Jung before his death in 1961? It was called Flying Saucers, A Modern Myth of Things Seen in the Skies. He didn't believe in aliens. He believed in examining the psychological significance, or more specifically, the archetypal meaning, of false sightings of such elusive spacecraft. So in his life, he shunned making sexuality, aka human reproduction, the core principle of our personality, in favor of focusing on examining the brain in that same context. Artificial brains soon arise in the form of early computer technology, along with machines designed to take us into the skies. Soon enough, we were going to space. And by the time he dies, he says, "Oh, by the way, we're all alone. There are no aliens." So Young's mission, though not explicit in his stated desires, was to engineer the movement away from the earthbound evolution we knew up until the Industrial Revolution, shunning exploration of our sexuality as the core issue because it was obsolete, and embracing understanding of the brain. We're currently in that phase of evolution he ignited right now, and it's the last stop along the way. What I mean is that this is the phase in which, by its end, we'll have cut the cord from evolution by way of technological implementation of AI. Once that phase is complete, evolution is toast. It's rendered entirely obsolete in relation to humanity. Having broken free from the intuitive connection to nature through the brain, we begin a new phase of existence I call metamorphosis, in which AI, and by extension, immortality, in addition to the switch from sexual reproduction to technological replication, will allow individuals autonomy and change at unprecedented levels. That's the importance of Jung telling Freud to fuck off, despite being greatly affected by the deteriorating friendship. He couldn't compromise. The basis for it, when projected well into the future, was the eventual transition from sexual reproduction to artificial replication through AI. But that phase of evolution starts with the brain rather than sexuality, thus the big disagreement. Now, when I discuss evolution, sometimes it's in the context of the macro and others the micro. Replacement of the brain to transcend evolution's influence is the macro element of this final phase we're in right now. But when broken down into the individual fibers of its construction, it's every movement we see in front of our eyes on a daily basis. All of our movements and speech, collectively, comprise a never-ending story where conflict affords us technological solutions. And that's the short version. Okay, next question. If you weren't podcasting, what would you be doing? Probably eating out of a dumpster and begging you for change? Well, you might not mean it that way. I'm guessing the question is, what would I like to do in the absence of podcasting or aside from podcasting? That's an easy one. You know, sometimes I think you have to look back to your early childhood, back to your innocence, so to speak, to know who you really are. We change so much over the years, but often we're born as a certain thing and truly just need to be that thing to have a good life, even though it still requires a lot of adaptation along the way. So, I think I've told this story before, but since I've done so many fucking episodes over the last 2 years, I can't remember shit, to be honest. So for anybody who hasn't heard it, or if I've actually never shared it, here goes. When I was 6 years old, my mom took me to a local video store to rent a movie. Of course, this was back before Netflix, and even before Netflix would send 3,976 DVDs to your house. So, you'd go into these places, these video stores, and the individual movies would all be on shelves facing you. So, my mom walks in here and takes me to the kids section, which was normal for a 6-year-old, of course. She then walks over to another section, looking for her own flick, like maybe a drama or something like that, I can't remember. But I never liked kids' stuff, so as soon as she turns her back, I make my move and head for the horror section. Next to that, they have all the action movies. Of course, I'm really short at the time, at 6 years old, and some of the movies are up on the top shelves. So, I see the cover of John Carpenter's Halloween, and I'm like, I must see this. So, I climb up and grab it. Then I notice The Road Warrior on another shelf. Looks like another great movie where all sorts of people are going to get slaughtered. So, I grab that one too. As my hand is on The Road Warrior, and I'm like standing on these shelves, which are probably about to fall, I hear my mom from behind me. She's like, Ryan, what are you doing? And I say, Mom, look, I found the movies I want. I hand her Halloween and The Road Warrior, and she looks at me like I'm a maniac. She tells me I need to get something from the kids section, but it was a losing battle. My parents pretty much knew I could read adult books for a couple years by that time, and so I just sort of bypassed the level of sophistication you'd encounter in most of those kids' movies. So she ends up renting these movies for me, and I'm totally pumped. We had just bought our first VCR, and we're heading home to check out these violent movies. So night falls, and I decide I want to watch Halloween. My mom sits down with me in case this movie gets so disturbing that she needs to turn it off. Well, I'm in love with this thing from the first frame. I mean, totally engrossed in the madness, on the edge of my seat, and to this day, it's still my favorite movie. Anyway, we're coming down the home stretch of the film, and Jamie Lee Curtis, as Laurie Strode, is having the climactic showdown with Michael Myers, seemingly about to succumb to the same fate as his previous victims. And that's when I jump to my feet on the couch, start pumping my fist, and yell, "Get her! Get her!" So my mom instantly pauses the video, and I turn to see this incredulous look on her face. She says, "Ryan, do you realize you're rooting for the killer? What's wrong with you?" And I replied, "Oh, Mom, you don't understand. The people who get killed in these movies agreed to do it because the producers pay their families a lot of money after they're dead." And there's this look plastered in her face like, "I can't believe my child is a maniac." But she could see the excitement and the passion. It just couldn't be stopped. So she hits play on the video again, and I've been that person ever since. Obviously, I soon came to realize the deaths were dramatized, and rooting for the killer was a low percentage play in the end, but I loved stories, and I knew that I loved film. Exploring the darkness of the human condition through violent films is something I loved right from the start. So, anyway, soon after, my teachers at school started calling home to tell my parents I had a lot of creative writing talent. And those two things, film and writing, became a dream for me. It's definitely my greatest strength, I would say. I write well, and I have an architectural mind, so writing things like screenplays and teleplays is my passion. That's part of the reason I ended up with this podcast. I had written a couple of TV pilots in the crime genre after experiencing some disappointing developments with a few feature scripts, and they were very well received. A few people felt like one of them could be the next True Detective, while the other was too much like Breaking Bad, yet it would be a great writing sample. Of course, it's difficult to get anybody to read pilots when you're an outsider to that industry, so when the prospect of true crime podcasting came into focus, I thought, you know, this might be an opportunity to showcase my unique writing voice. And that's been the case. So, yeah, screenwriting is definitely what I would otherwise be doing, and I think that dream is alive and well. Okay, next question. Oh, this is a classic. Have you ever killed anyone? That would be a no. As I've said on the show before, serial killers are glorified for their cleverness all the time. But in reality, if you haven't killed anybody, you're smarter than anybody who has. Thinking your logic is going to be superior to a police force equipped with technology is ridiculous. Do people get away with murder? Sure, but it's like winning at a casino. You're gambling. The odds say you have a good chance of losing. So, it's always better to refrain. I recommend it. Okay, so I'm going to have to do a part two on this in the near future. I have limited time at the moment due to my production schedule. So, there's more to cover, and if I didn't answer your question, I'll be back to answer it soon in part two. But let's do one more first. If you could change anything about the world, what would it be? That's another good one. You know, what I really hate to see is people or animals suffering, either emotionally or physically. But at the same time, you know, I'm a cog in the wheel of a world that contributes to that suffering. Yet, because my brain is geared toward long-term evolutionary solutions rather than short-term fixes in society, I often feel like I'm on the outside looking in, as it relates to my contribution to eradicating those things. However, I do have a lot of hope for the future, specifically within the context of these ideas I present. I do believe that AI will allow us to shed the burden of the human condition for a data-based operating system, and in turn, we will know lives that are far superior to what nature affords us now. In the meantime, though, while I do take my analysis very seriously, I also realize I'm completely ridiculous, and you should too. At best, my thoughts provoke deeper reflection of who you are now and what you wish to become, while at worst, I'm just an idiot. But if there's anything I can assure you, it's that I really do care. So, wherever we're all headed, it's my pleasure to be along for the ride. Until then, be the thing no one else can, offer the world your truth, and remember to shine.